It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosi. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. Joining me in studio is film sociology intern McKenna Mays, who is making her interview debut this week with an interview with Ed Trout of Comedy Sports. Comedy Sports is celebrating their 25th anniversary Saturday night at the Athenaeum, so she'll be talking a little bit to Ed about the event as well as the history of Comedy Sports. And back on Film Sociology, Mary Jo Peel of Mystery Science Theater and Cinematic Titanic fame. We talk about the video release of Cinematic Titanic, the Mystery Science Theater reboot, as well as a project that Mary Jo has been working on for 2018. So good to have her back on the show. But first, full disclosure, one of the films I wanted to talk about was supposed to open in Indy this week, and it got moved to next week, and that just kind of threw my schedule off. So with that in mind, however, there is a film, a documentary, with a local slant, and it came out this week, and it's available on iTunes and Amazon, and McKenna and I actually watched it together. This is for educational work purposes only. But the documentary Dead Man's Live, about the hostage situation that happened in Indianapolis in 1977. McKenna knew nothing about it, wow. So, you know, hey, journalism history here. But it's the story, of course, of Tony Corretis, who took a mortgage executive hostage for 60 hours. And I wanted to get your tell the folks what, because I've seen the footage, not this much footage, but tell the folks what you saw and what you thought.
I mean, obviously, I'd never heard of it before, so it was all really new and surprising to me. And I guess I've never, like, from a journalist standpoint, all of the press footage and how they were covering the event was, like, all really interesting to me. And like the press conferences, how those were handled, super stressful, and I just don't know how I would have handled a situation like that.
Which is why she wants to go into entertainment journals. I understand. We get it. Because there's, for some, it's a very, very tense situation. The footage on this, and kudos to all the news outlets here in Indy for revealing this. Most of this 90-plus minute documentary, the footage more than likely speaks for itself. There are recent interviews with the likes of Tom Cochran and others, but it's the footage that's really striking, and the audio, especially stuff that I don't think had ever been released before, like conversations with Tony and the news director. This is a film that could be made hundreds of times, from Dog Day Afternoon to Money Monster to any other hostage film that we've seen over the decades. But the characteristics and not the performance, but the roller coaster that Tony goes through in these 60 hours that we see on tape, that we hear on tape. It's stuff that I think actors try to recreate. That's the goal. It's really, really unsettling, the ups and downs that this goes through.
Mm-hmm. The whole vibe of it was really interesting because it is dark and it is a tense situation, But I think Tony's character really comes through where he injects moments of, like, comedy, and it's humorous, and you want to laugh, but then you think of the situation. And
with a shotgun strapped to a guy's face, to a head. Yeah. A lot of one moment he's screaming, another moment he's talking to police officers who he has a great deal of respect for, and then another person who, you know, whose brother winds up coming to the apartment complex. And that adds to the tension of, you know, he's the other part is that this is 1977, and it's something that everybody who goes into a hostage situation, he thinks he gets what he wants as far as the television time, the attention, the fact that this is, I say with air quotes, granted to him and it is aired. Which you could never do today. Never, never, never. And I'm sure this helped set the precedent for that. I know it did with the when we find out later in the trial as far as the defense using insanity as a defense, which is now almost never done. But yeah, really striking. And as McKenna and I were watching it, you know, you also have not just the people involved, the police involved. And the reporting involved. They're all a part of this, but also the fact that, you know, it's also tension for them. I think reporters in film, except for films like Spotlight and The Post, you know, get the bad rap of just being microphone shovers, and the fact that we see, I think in some cases, the seasoned reporters really thrown, really shaken because it's happening live, because you know, something's going on in the back and you have to find the information right then and there, as opposed to just standing there and blathering. It's raw and unpolished, and you can't have that in 2018. But in 1977, it was just at that, especially in an incident like this, it's quite the norm. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping to get Alan Berry, one of the filmmakers, on a future Film Sociology to discuss the film. So obviously this worked out for those who knew nothing about the incident itself, as well as somebody who remembers some of the history. But yeah, this is something, again, Hollywood can try to recreate, and they will. Maybe not this particular incident, but the footage is just bone chilling, and that's why we have documentaries. So yeah, definitely go look for that on iTunes and on Amazon. Now, McKenna and I know there's a lot of folks, we are in catch-up mode as far as the films that have been nominated or stuff that you just come across. And you watched a couple films recently that I have seen, but you start. What have you watched recently?
I think it started after I watched the Golden Globes, and I was like, I really need to catch up for Oscars.
Thus the purpose, yes.
Yeah. And so I watched I, Tonya, Lady Bird, and Three Billboards probably within the span of a week.
Okay, let's say not at once.
No.
And all right, let's start your thoughts on I, Tonya.
I, Tonya, it was good. I really enjoyed Allison Janney's character of
one of the worst mothers ever.
Terrible mother. Terribly entertaining though. Yeah, it was great.
Have you seen? I bring this up with I, Tonya, and I do with Molly's Game. But have you seen Goodfellas?
No.
Okay, because those are, I think, Molly's Game and I, Tonya are the two of the finer Goodfellas imitations when it comes to the use of narration and use of storytelling. Mm-hmm. Between and in this case, there's sit down interviews, while Goodfellas is done, and Casino to another degree is done in voiceover. So now, oh God, you weren't alive during the Tonya and Nancy Kerrigan. No, you weren't.
No.
Okay. Sorry. Sometimes Matt Soucy's in his own little world, so we just got to check in on ages and times and things. Well, here's two news incidents I didn't know you didn't know about, and now you do. So, yeah, I Tonya, trying to make her the most sympathetic of that group. She wasn't the only victim. Yeah, anyway.
I don't know. Like, I think it's interesting when, because they had the documentary about this, like a big news documentary.
Yeah, good timing on that.
Yeah, great timing. But, like, going into it, I thought Tonya Harding was the one who
actually did it.
Yeah.
No.
And I think that's, like, a big misconception.
Well, a little bit. Okay, a lot. But, but yeah, she's not really a victim. But, yeah, she's not the actual one that clubbed it. Yeah. Now, that would have been high-end drama. Mm-hmm. But, no. But, yeah, she just surrounded herself with very dim bulbs. Mm-hmm. That's, yeah. And you also said you saw Lady Bird?
Mm-hmm.
as a dad, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. You weren't like, well, there wasn't that much tension at home, I hope, your senior year of high school.
No, definitely not. But I do think it's interesting, the whole kind of wanting to branch out and see new things and coming from like a small income family that
well, this
not necessarily
is
impossible.
But this is nice. You used to like this.
Yeah.
See, parents' stance point of view, child's point of view. Yes. Yeah, I watching that with wife and daughter, it's I understand. Mm-hmm. And as a former teenager myself, decades removed. I get that. Mm-hmm. By the way, Saoirse Ronan is fantastic. She's not Greta Gerwig. We know this is not about Greta Gerwig's life story. I'm joking, of course. And as a parent, I still say that the hardest I cried, yeah, I do, at movies, was Laurie Metcalf in the car at the airport. Mm-hmm. You just don't want to end a day like that with your kids. So, but yeah, nice accurate slice of teen angst and a little mom angst too. Mm-hmm. So.
A little bit.
Okay, so you saw those, you enjoyed those. What was the other one? Three Billboards. That was my top pick. Now your thoughts on it.
I really liked it. Frances McDormand's character, like, wow.
Force of nature.
Yeah, stoic, unnerving, unforgiving.
But right. There's those moments
where,
because she's Frances and she gets to have those. But yeah, I think you want Frances McDormand to have your back in a bar fight.
Definitely. She's kind of terrifying.
Right. It's like, so long as she's your kind of terrifying.
Yes.
Okay. So I, without giving away too much, I've talked about this before on previous shows that I consider it an operatic film as far as heightened emotions and, in this case, rooted performances. They're not heightened performances. But as far as the story and the action, without giving away a lot again, the relationship between Frances McDormand's character and Sam Rockwell's character, and especially the Rockwell character itself, mm-hmm. Where they wind up at point A and then by the time they're done with point B. Mm-hmm. And I think that for some, because it's operatic, because it's heightened, I think some audience members might find it a little hard to swallow. Did you find it a little hard to swallow?
I did.
Okay.
I'm not necessarily sure that his character deserved what he got in the end, as in sympathy.
Now we're talking in generalities. Folks.
Yeah, I don't want to give too much away,
right.
But I don't think he deserved that sympathy that he got.
Why not?
He's just, like, yeah, there's character development, but it doesn't forgive everything that he's done in the past.
Like what he's been accused of
yes.
by the, and the incident. Don't sit near a window with Sam Rockwell. It was Sam Rockwell's character.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, all right. It's just, I will say this. It's almost an art house version of cop and, it is kind of to a certain degree, cop and criminal having to work together. Or the, I don't like you, but we have a mutual thing of getting the job done.
Mm-hmm.
Could you see it that way?
I can see it that way. Yeah.
Okay. We're talking in civil generalities. All right. So we're kind of three for three on that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you saw one I didn't expect you to see because I thought it kind of got lost in the shuffle. And I know it's available on video and it's on streaming and all that. Mm-hmm. What else did you see?
I saw Thelma.
Now, for those who don't remember, this is a college girl who finds out she has telekinetic powers. So of a certain generation like mine, it's like if Carrie White had gone to college, got out of the house, had a different and had two messed up parents as opposed to one, and then add the college student anxieties of being with others, being with boys, maybe being with girls, partying, trying to study, all of that, all of the college student anxieties on top of the family and telekinesis. McKenna, are you okay?
I'm okay.
Okay. How did you like it? Or did you? Did you?
I did like it, yeah. It was definitely interesting. Would prefer Carrie. I did like that one better.
Well, I understand. There are times where you can say, well, I didn't like it because it ripped off Carrie. And you go, I did like it because it's an homage to Carrie.
Yeah.
So It sounds like a more homage for you.
Yeah, and it was definitely, like, I think in a lot of LGBT films, they kind of lack a plot. And this one definitely had a plot, one of the better ones that I've seen. Yeah.
Cool. So, yeah, did you stream that one?
Yeah.
Okay, so it is out there, and that was one of the first screeners I got for award consideration. So this is like October, November. Mm-hmm. Obviously pushing in the foreign film category. But yeah, one is not to be missed. There's no blood and gore or anything. Mm-hmm. It's not prom night like at the end of Carrie. But there are those telekinetic moments. On top of, as we alluded to, as far as campus anxiety, mm-hmm. in a really in-depth way. So I don't watch that in Lady Bird in the same day.
No.
Now, as you are a guest, and we appreciate your company, if I've not given you this advice, I guess I should give it to you now. If you watch something like Thelma, or if you watch something like Three Billboards, don't watch it and then go to bed. Cleanse your palate. Watch Bob's Burgers or Archer or something light, because you don't want to see something extremely heavy and I'm just going to go to sleep.
I know.
Okay, just making sure. We're a healthy intern. So, all right, with that in mind, we are going to head down. Are we on time? 36. Good. We're going to head and just a couple of notes of what is going on around at IU Cinema. If you are listening to this at 10 o'clock or on Saturday, you have a chance, 7 o'clock at IU Cinema on Saturday, February 10th, for Invocation of My Demon Brother, as well as La Chinoise from 1967 and 1969 as part of Wounded Galaxy's 1968. On Sunday, the 11th, at 3 p.m., the double feature of, two short films, Daisies and Kusama's Self-Obliteration. And then at 6:30 p.m., Otto Preminger's Skidoo from 1968. If you want to see a big budget film's bad interpretation of hallucinogenics and LSD, starring those counterculture icons Jackie Gleason, Carol Channing, and most of the cast of Batman, as well as the 1967 comedy Looking for Mushrooms. That is Sunday at 6:30 p.m. Monday, February 12th, Marlena and the Murderer in four acts at 7 p.m. Thursday, the 15th, from 2017, Golden Exits at 7 p.m. Friday, February 16th, Alex Ross Perry's lecture at 3 p.m., The Color Wheel at 6:30 p.m., and Queen of Earth at 9:30 p.m. And then Saturday, February 17th, you ever seen any Charlie Chaplin, McKenna?
Oh, I had to watch one in my film literature class from high school.
Do you remember which one?
I don't.
Do you remember what he does?
No.
Besides be the little tramp. Okay, we're going to work on that. Saturday, February 17th, the 1931 classic, City Lights. I remember seeing this in the theater with my daughter, and I burst into tears. I'm that guy. Yeah. This was actually on the South Side. And then at 7 p.m., the 1972 documentary, A Sense of Loss. All of that happening at IU Cinema. And then mark your calendars, folks, over at the Artcraft Theater in Franklin, February 23rd and 24th. The first Shrek. You grew up on Shrek, I'm guessing?
Definitely,
okay.
Yes.
Okay, all right. I have one issue with the first Shrek.
What?
The theme of the first Shrek is accept people for who they are unless you're short like Farquaad, and then you can make fun of his height.
Well, he was kind of a jerk, then.
Yeah, but a jerk. Not a short jerk, anyway. And then March 2nd and 3rd, Friday and Saturday at the Artcraft Theater, the best of the fest of the Heartland International Film Festival. So 7:30 on Friday, 2:35 and 7:30 p.m. on Saturday the 3rd. All right, making her interview debut here at Film Sociology, McKenna, congratulations. She talked with one of the longtime founder, remember, and member of Comedy Sports, Ed Trout, to discuss the Comedy Sports 25th anniversary, which is happening tonight at the Athenaeum at 7:30 p.m. or 7. Double check. Anyway, here's her chat with Ed Trout. Enjoy.
So my first question is, how did you initially get involved with improv?
I initially got involved with improv from doing other local theater, and we started doing some more experimental stuff And there was a core group of us that ended up doing not only sketch work, but then the sketch work sort of evolved into and evolved from some improvisational work. And that then started becoming more of an impetus to do more and more improv. So Below the Belt was the name of the sketch and improv group that I worked with way back in the day.
And from there, how did Comedy Sports and CSC kind of happen?
We had an audition for new performers with Below the Belt. And through that audition, we got a performer named Randy Smock, who had worked with CSZ and Comedy Sports in Chicago. And so he talked about the show format and what a great relatable format it was. And we opted to kind of switch our formats from that sketch and improv to the fully improvised Comedy Sports match.
And now that you're going into your 25th year of business, how were the shows in the beginning compared to where they are now?
In the beginning, things were a lot looser. We had certainly less training, less experience. They were very fun, and they were still clean shows for everybody. But over the years, they've gotten to feel a little more polished, a little more clean, a little more fast-paced, a little more energetic. So it's just grown because not only have we worked here locally, but there are other CSZ cities all over, and we workshop with them every summer as part of the World Championship. So it's inevitable that there will be a lot of performer growth in that too.
And what's it like to get to work with people from all of these different companies?
It is really awesome. It's great to see different styles, but also then to find skill sets that some people exhibit naturally, and you can learn from how they utilize skill sets that you didn't even realize you were missing.
And Comedy Sports is like specifically your competitive improvised comedy event, right?
That is correct. Yeah, it's the two teams and the referee, and intended to be for everybody.
Okay, and how would you kind of explain it to somebody who's never been to a show?
I would say you start out by thinking of a sporting event, but the way that the sport is played is through improvisation. So everything's based off of audience suggestions. Some of the games are head-to-head. Some of them are single team. A lot of audience participation and voting, and a lot of fun.
So what are some of the other events that you guys do?
We have other shows. We have our late-night shows that tend to be the 17 and up performances. We also have a lot of workshops that we do, both public workshops where we train in improvisation, but also a lot of private workshops and corporate workshops where we teach applied improvisation. So it's not for performance sake, but more for working better as a team, being more creative and collaborative, and so on.
Can you explain some of the components of improv?
Absolutely. The biggest order of improv is that you accept other people's ideas. There's a mantra known as yes and, where whatever somebody is throwing out, you don't want to push back on it. You want to accept that their reality is real for them and then work with that.
Okay.
So there's also a real sense of paying attention, being very present-minded with what's going on, because if somebody's throwing out an idea and you're not catching it, that doesn't do anybody any good. We also really work collaboratively. So you lend your strengths to other players. You let them help you out where you need it. We ideally just have fun, right? It's a lot of energy and a lot of passion that we put out there, and we want to have fun with it. That way the audience can have fun too.
Mm-hmm. And do you ever notice improv being used in film?
Yeah, you do. There are a lot of films that will have a structured story, but they improvise the dialogue. But I've also been witness to films that are completely improvised from beginning to end. As part of the Applied Improv Network, of which I'm a member, there are some groups, especially some from Europe, who simply start with characters, and then they allow the film to improvise from there. And it's really amazing sometimes what turns up.
So when can you see the Comedy Sports Show? Which days does it happen?
We have regular performances every Thursday, Friday, Saturday evening on Massachusetts Avenue. The Thursdays are at 7, and the Fridays and Saturdays are 7:30, plus a matinee on Saturdays, normally at 4:30. But this particular weekend, we also have our big 25th extravaganza, which is on Saturday at 7:30 down at the Athenaeum because it's too big for our space to hold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to ask, are you doing anything else for your big 25th anniversary?
We just came off of last weekend's 25-hour marathon, so we had 13 back-to-back comedy sports matches, and we were also raising money for 5 different charities throughout that. We also have our late-night shows reflecting audience and player votes for their top choices of performance that were the non-comedy sports shows. So for this month, we brought back Scary Tales, a special Valentine's edition of Christmas Carol. We have the Blue Show, a long-form show called The Experiment. And then we're finishing out the month with our fully improvised two-act musical, The A Musical.
And can you please give me your website and contact info?
Absolutely. You can reach our website at www.czindianapolis.com. And our phone number is 317-951-8499. And that will get you to our theater at 721 Massachusetts Avenue, right in the heartbeat there of the Theater and Arts District.
That's McKenna Mays talking to Ed Trout of Comedy Sports. The 25th anniversary celebration Saturday night. So if you're listening to this on Saturday, good for you. 7:30 p.m. at the Athenaeum. So go check that out. And, of course, you can check out Comedy Sports all weekend long. Thank you so much, McKenna. We appreciate the audio.
You're welcome.
And you'll be hearing more of her throughout the semester. All right. With that in mind, here is my semi-epic chat with Mary Jo Peel of Mystery Science Theater and Cinematic Titanic fame, talking about, well, Mystery Science Theater, Cinematic Titanic, and a project that she is, I guess, devoting a good chunk of 2018 to. Enjoy. Mary Jo, welcome back to Film Sociology. I think there have been Academy Award winners easier to get back on than you.
Oh, sorry about that.
Oh, stop. Nothing to be sorry about. That's life and show business gets in the way. How are you?
Yeah, if only.
In that order. Right. Life first. what is 2018 looking like for you?
Wow, that's so open-ended. I don't know yet.
Okay.
It's looking like saying no to a lot of gigs that aren't fulfilling, or I tend to overcommit, and so I'm trying not to do that, and in turn I'm writing more and feeling a little less pressure in my life. I don't know if that's answering your question. What does 2018 look like for you? And then I'm going to copy your answer.
No, I'm saying getting in touch with you. No.
Voila.
No, if you don't mind me asking, can you share with us what you've been writing?
Yeah, I'm working on a memoir about my mother. She read voraciously, and she kept this little card catalog. It's about the size of a recipe box, and she had like 400. Over 400 little index cards with all the books she had read, because she read so much, she'd start forgetting what she read. And she'd be in the middle of a book, and she'd say, damn it, I swear I've read this before. So she started keeping notes for herself on these little index cards. And her summaries about some of these books are absolutely hilarious, and some of them are really interesting too. Like sometimes she'll say a book was hard for her to read or hit too close to home. So I'm sort of exploring those ideas, and mostly it's just about the funny, because these cards, I don't think they were ever intended for anyone else to read, but they're very amusing and really illuminating about my mother. And then when she died about 4 years ago, my father gave me a box of little mini reviews. So that's my big focus right now.
Of the 400 some odd cards, how many of those books have you read?
Oh, what a great question. You know, I would say only about 10 at the most. At the most. What a curious, interesting question. Yeah, and it piqued my interest about other books. Like sometimes she'll say, she'll get so indignant about books. She started reading one, and in her summation, she says, started reading and the author used the word eschatological on the fourth page. I got so mad, I quit. So I really, you know, that's something my mother and I share, that sort of impatience. But I would say I've only, maybe 6, 7, 8
okay.
of those books.
Can you share with us what some of those books were?
Yes, Life of Pi, Gone with the Wind, although she doesn't have a card for that because she started the card file, I think, when she was in her late 60s, and she'd read Gone with the Wind before then. She's Come Undone by Wally Lamb.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I can recall right now.
Okay.
Those are three that come to mind.
Well, when my first instinct was when you said you discovered this, I thought you were going to do a Julie and Julia thing and try to read all of the books that she has read.
No, and Matthew, I honestly thought of that, but it would take me.
Yeah.
I'd never get the book done.
Right.
You know, it's such a great idea, and I have checked out some of the books that she has had a strong reaction to. Like, there's some book where she says the first 3 pages were gross and disgusting, but she doesn't say why. And so I check those books out to see what she's getting at. So that's been really interesting about what sets her off, aside from the word eschatological.
If you don't mind me asking, what did set her off?
The one book she was referring to, I want to say the author's name is Walter Mosley, and he's got a character, which, forgive me, I can't recall. So he's written several books with the same detective character.
Easy Rollins.
Yes, yes.
Yep.
So whatever book it was, apparently one of his informants is a hooker, and in the first 3 pages of this particular book, the hooker offers him a blowjob. And my mother would not cotton to that, so she returns that book, and that was that.
So your mother believes in getting information in other ways.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's so interesting to me because she was really, really progressive and really enlightened. But you can't take the Midwestern out of the girl, I guess.
Well, and I when I direct plays, I've had to argue with producers that I would say, I think rape, genocide, and cancer are worse than some of the 7 words you can't say on television.
Well, right. Right. But on the other hand, you know, if it offends your sensibilities, or it's not if it's not presented in a way that, you know, I know I have my reactions to stuff, too. I absolutely agree with you, but I know I have my reactions to things, too. Words, not so much like that. I don't have strong reactions to words, mostly speaking, I guess,
okay.
Depending on context.
Sure. So how much, if you don't mind me asking, how much of an influence was your mom in your Mystery Science Theater cinematic Titanic work?
Well, I refer to her sometimes, I think. She had this really sly sense of humor. Like, everyone thinks that I got my sense of humor from my dad because he's very, he's got a really corny dad sense of humor, and he's very jovial and laughs easily. But my mom was the funny one for sure. She just had this really sly sense of humor that would come out when you weren't expecting it. And so I think she informed my sense of humor on several levels. And I think that was always made manifest in Mystery Science Theater and Cinematic Titanic.
Were your parents riffers at home?
No. No, not to the extent that I am or was.
Right.
I mean, they would comment on stuff and roll their eyes. And I remember not too long after my mom died, I was sitting with my father watching TV, and a Viagra ad came on. It was either Cialis or Viagra.
Sure.
And this ad came on, and it's one where a man and a woman, older couple, are playing golf. And she playfully pockets the ball into the cup and then winks at him, and it's all fun and games. And my dad goes, yeah, she cheats, and then they have sex. It was so random. It was so funny. It's just his observations, like, oh, the way of the world. You cheat at golf, and then you get to have sex. I don't know. It struck me so funny. I'm sorry I'm rambling, Matthew.
No, absolutely not. I think I'm sure the director and the producers of that commercial also love the sitcoms with the fat, funny guys and the smoking hot wives.
Right.
So, no.
You know, it's all playful and wonderful and... Just my father's observation on it was funny.
Forget all that. She cheats at golf.
Right.
So one of the reasons why I wanted you back on because, well, honestly, the last time we chatted, it was so much fun. And I don't know if you know, but there's a piece of audio that is now part of film sociology lore. And it's
no, what?
When you called me a terrible father for showing my daughter Manos the Hands of Fate.
Oh,
And justifiably so. And by the way, I've also graduated to terrible friend because I inflicted it on two other people.
Okay. Wow. You're batting 100 with your social life, aren't you?
Yeah. Thank you.
Your interpersonal relationships.
Yep. Just making the world better one bad screening at a time. But for almost a year now, I have ended the show with that little clip followed by Bill O'Reilly screaming, "We'll do it live." I think it's a good way to end a show.
Oh, that's so funny.
So thank you for that contribution.
You're welcome.
But I guess I go back because, and this goes back to the release, the home video release of Cinematic Titanic on Shout Factory. Which I'd never seen before until I got to the videos. I guess going back, how did that organization come about? I would say reunion, but it's a different, it's a different show for the most part.
Yeah, it's a different configuration.
Right.
Let's see, Joel, I was living in Austin, Texas at the time, and Joel called me, or I was visiting LA for some reason, and he wanted to get together for lunch, and I hadn't been in much contact with him since the show ended. And Frank was living in LA at the time, so the three of us had lunch. And then he kind of broached this idea, what if we did this live? It would be the five of us. And he mentioned some other names. And I can't remember if he thought it would be better to have the group larger. But he mentioned some names of people who had not been originally associated with Mystery Science Theater. And but obviously the core group ended up being the five of us. Mm-hmm. and we didn't start out live, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
And we started videotaping those things, and he tried to come up with a mythology, and then as you might have noticed, as time goes on, we shed the mythology and started doing it live. People mm-hmm. Accepted it on those terms, and we traveled for about 6 years, I think, and it was a blast.
Yeah, what's been fun over the years, whether it's, I mean, there have been different incarnations of Mystery Science Theater, and of course there's the reboot, and then there's this group, and I know there's others, I know Riff Tracks, but everyone has a specifically different tone. It's almost like a jazz combination, and it's been fun.
Oh, interesting.
It's been fun to hear those different combinations, and I know you guys, I'm guessing the Titanic group, you guys have known each other the longest, or at least there's some partnerships that have been very long?
I'm thinking. Yeah, I think it goes person by person. I think, I'm not sure if I'm answering your speculation, but I think I've known all those guys. I never worked with Josh on the show on Mystery Science Theater,
mm-hmm.
but I did know him way back in the day from doing stand-up comedy.
How did the films get selected for Cinematic Titanic? Because I noticed that they were all with one production company or whatever was in the vault for Shout Factory. How did those get selected?
Well, we didn't get them through Shout Factory. We negotiated individual deals, and there were one or two, maybe three, I can't remember, that were public domain. And Wasp Woman was public domain, but Roger Corman asserted that it wasn't. So we were about to perform Wasp Woman, and I'm not kidding. We were doing it at the L.A. Amphitheater, the Ford Amphitheater, and we were rehearsing it. about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and we were going to do a show at 7, and we got a cease and desist from Roger Corman, even though he didn't own the rights. But we decided to not press the issue, and on the fly we came up with a different movie. I can't remember what it was, but circle back to your question, many of them, we had no budget. We had a tiny budget, so we got some of them on the cheap, but a couple of them are public domain.
Okay. Yes, I wrote down a couple titles I remember, like Blood of the Vampire and East Meets Watts and Alien mm-hmm. Factor. And I think, and there was what I believe was, there was a film that involved Filipino blackface.
Yes, what was that one? I think that might be Blood of the Vampire.
It was a Filipino vampire movie, but there were characters. It was supposed to be set, I think, on an American plantation, and there were Filipino people in blackface. I don't think that's ever been done.
It was a Filipino movie, but it was supposed to, it's kind of ambiguous about where it's supposed to take place, but they are trying to make some overtures to, this is not the Philippines, whatever you're thinking.
I guess overall, and how long did you, I mean, I know it was on and off, but how long did you, was Cinematic Titanic afloat? Haha.
About 6 years.
Mm-hmm. And, when did you guys know to just call it quits?
I think Joel was ready to, move on. And when he decided not to, continue with it, the rest of us decided that was, you know, the end of it, that we didn't want to continue on as a foursome. It had gotten, and I don't think it was just Joel deciding he didn't want to do it anymore. I think we all were kind of worn out with travel for 5 people. You know, it's a great gig to have, but it's also really exhausting. I think we were pretty exhausted mm-hmm. by that time. So I think that was just the thing that solidified it for us. Like, okay, this has lived its life. It's been a great 6 years, and if one person feels like he needs to drop out, then you know that's the way of it. And then I think he was really starting to ramp up the reboot. He was really wanting to focus on the reboot.
Mm-hmm. And you got to do a little bit of the reboot. It was fun. It was fun seeing familiar faces pop up. How was the experience for you?
Oh, it was a blast. It was really fun. It was really interesting because it was this huge budget. I walked into the studio and there were 3 different stages,
mm-hmm.
very elaborately and beautifully produced, something that I wasn't used to, because Mystery Science Theater had such a small budget, and it intentionally gave the look of just by the skin of our teeth, and we pulled all this stuff out from a garage sale or the back of our, you know, in our garage. And it was just, the production level was very different than what I was used to from Mystery Science Theater. And on the flip side, I didn't have to do any heavy lifting. I had to learn my lines, and they had production people doing all that stuff, and it was a small part that I was doing. So it was kind of fun just to be able to walk in and do my thing and not have to worry about all the other elements, because I'm very codependent, and I'll worry about everything. So
mm-hmm. watching, and I think, no matter who, in regards to the reboot, you know, we've never forgotten what, that the meat and potatoes is the film itself. I mean, there's just moments, riffing or not, where, like Filipino blackface, it just kind of speaks for itself. You just can't believe you're seeing it.
Right.
And, well, I mean, I know what was often said with the reboot is that they're young and there's a lot of riffs. I mean, it's like a young kid always shooting the basket, but, and again, it's a different pace. It's a different tone. And but it was fun to see some familiar faces pop up here and there. And as like you said, not have to carry a giant load.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I was curious over the years when you guys would sit down and work on the material, I know, time out the riffs, was there ever riff sharing amongst you if you said something and you thought it would be better said by somebody else? Has that ever happened?
Mystery Science Theater or
any of them?
Cinematic Titanic.
Any of them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think I can't speak much to Mystery Science Theater, but I do know that in the writing room, if one of the actors felt like, oh, somebody else has a better impersonation than I do, there was always shifting. There was always a lot of give and take. I think the really cool thing was that people were really interested and focused on making it a good script. So there wasn't a lot of ego about I can't do my, you know, whatever impersonation, but I'm going to steal this line anyway, or I have to hold on to it. People were very generous that way and realizing what would serve the script and the show best. And I would say the same for Cinematic Titanic. Absolutely. In fact, I ended up actually accidentally stealing one of Josh's lines. I said it during a live show because I wasn't following my script as I should have been. And it's one of the funniest lines ever in the whole world. He wrote it. It's his line. I always like to give him credit for it. And then after that, he was so generous. He said, nope, you take it. They loved it. It's all yours.
What was
so
it?
It's the one where they're trapped on an island. They come on a boat. I'm sorry, all the titles.
I know.
The titles
it's
run
okay.
together. And it's this oversexed wife and the husband who ignores her, and she hits on all the men on the island. And then the horror element is all these trees that come to life and
yes.
strangle people. And she's in the woods, and this tree comes to life and starts to bear down on her. And she looks up at him, at the tree, and the line is, oh, she's thinking about it. And it's such a fantastic, beautifully simple line. Josh is such a great joke writer. And I just said it one time, just not paying attention, and he's been very generous with it.
It's funny you mentioned that, because I had a few lines I've written on my legal pad, and one of them, and it could be the same character, but I have written hornier than an early Chicago album.
Yeah, that might be. I can't remember what movie that.
Well, and I know I'm asking you because this is stuff that you've done over a decade ago. You mentioned the touring thing. I mean, there is kind of a band element. You're like, what city are we in? What movie are we watching?
Right.
You know,
right.
What was that? Yeah, what was the one with the killer trees from 10 years ago? I guess to this day, do you still get people coming up and yelling riffs at you or with you?
Oh, yeah. And they'll say this thing to me, and first of all, I don't know them, so it's contextual, you know. No, and I don't mean
yeah.
to be rude.
No,
or anything,
I know.
But it comes out of the blue. And what are you saying? And they think that I automatically remember every riff that's ever been said, and I don't. And I barely remember. I can remember scenes from movies, but titles at this point start to escape me, obviously.
Yes.
But it's funny that it's funny and endearing that people have latched on to those things. I just feel bad that I'm looking at them blankly, like, what are you on about? And then they'll have to catch me up to speed and refresh my memory.
Right.
But yeah.
Because you riffed it once and we've been saying it for like 15 years.
Yeah, isn't that funny? Yeah, and I think people think that I or we, any of us, revisit the shows a lot. And I really don't. I mean, sometimes I watch them with my husband, and it's really fun to get this perspective now that I'm not self-conscious about seeing myself or my lines on the screen. So I enjoy them with, you know, an affectionate detachment.
You're not Norma Desmond.
Right, right. Yeah, I lived with it, for 9 days during a writing cycle, and that was fine. That was good.
I can tell you from both ends, I guess, as a dad and a fan, and then as obviously with this show, there is that we've been quoting it a lot longer than you have. I mean, there's people who talk in sarcasm and movie quotes and certain elements, like my daughter and I were in a show together and we were backstage, and anytime at least two or three names are said in a row, one of us is going to say Chief and the other is going to say McCloud. It's just, it's like honking after after hearing two hard-boiled eggs. It's just a natural reflex for some.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And I know, going back to Mystery Science Theater for a little bit, I know that I was watching the latest box set, and I guess I'm trying to – can you recall why or how Diabolik became the last film of the series?
No, but I'm sure it was not necessarily intentional or strategic. I think on most of the films, it was just what we could get with our budget and a streamlined rights issue. So I don't think it was strategic or intentional. I think that's just how it ended up.
Well, I have to say, watching that, because I had not seen that one before, and then when Pearl trashes her castle, it had elements of Tommy Wiseau's trashing the apartment in The Room.
Oh, my God. I never thought of that.
This is your pledge dollars at work right here. I guess shifting gears a little bit, because this is a film show, what have you watched recently, new, old, or indifferent, for leisure, for fun?
Oh, I have seen Three Billboards. I have seen The Room. What's the name of it?
The Disaster
James
Artist?
James Franco. Yeah, Disaster Artist, The Shape of Water. I've actually been pretty active in actually going out to movies and not necessarily watching them on my iPad. And I can't remember what I've seen recently on my iPad. I'm watching the second season of Fargo, which I never got around to, so I'm catching up with that.
Mm-hmm. Any particular favorites from recent? My top film from last year was Three Billboards.
I really liked it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was terrific. It's kind of hard to stomach, but it there are a lot of things in it that are so painful. But it was really interesting because I felt like it was kind of like in Bruges, where there are things that happen that are almost a little surreal or unreal, but the universe that Martin McDonagh has set up kind of allows for it. So I was just, making those comparisons when people say, but this doesn't make sense. That's not realistic. But that's what he sets up in Bruges too. But I went along with it. So I think I'm just prattling right now.
No.
I'm still digesting like his method and why you're going along with it.
With three billboards, I refer to it as operatic, as far as, and I think of some Coppola films are operatic, where it's heightened story, heightened emotions. It's just you have a heightened storyline, but you have really grounded performances from everybody.
That's a really interesting, juxtaposition like that. Absolutely.
Because how else, without giving away too much, how else would those two characters at the end, who didn't like each other at the beginning, wind up to get working together at the end?
Right, but it makes sense because Frances McDormand, A, is so excellent, and
yep.
B, the script is so excellent that it makes sense what her motivations are and what she has been struggling with and what she's willing to it's a means to an end at that point.
Agreed. And sometimes you just need a pair of eyes and a point of view from outside the country to point out what's still happening in this part of the country.
That was a lot of really amazing stuff in that movie.
The one thing that still tickles me to this day watching it, and I think it because of the bar scene with Sam Rockwell, I'm fascinated to know when this was set, because I want to know what bar has Walk Away Renee by the Four Tops and Joan Baez's The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down on the jukebox.
That's so interesting. I didn't find that jarring at all, because you go into, you know, bars in rural Minnesota,
right,
and it's very eclectic like that. But not that I personally go into bars.
Oh, no. No. You're a craft beer lady. I understand. When you were done with Mr. Science Theater and Cinematic to Titanic, did you wean yourself from low-budget bad fare? Did you purge on, you know, art house material just to have a closure or a breakaway?
Yeah, I don't think it was intentional. I think there might have been a little intentionality to it, but yeah, I kind of needed to cleanse my palate. Around that time, that would have been the advent of watching things on your, you know, devices, and that was coming to bear. Mm-hmm. So, you just had access to more things, but I rarely ever chose something hokey or B-movie.
Mm-hmm.
I still kind of don't, because I can't not mentally comment on it, and I want to enjoy a movie. I mean, I'm mentally commenting, pointing out stuff in really good movies,
yep,
too. And I'm not bragging. I don't like it about myself, but it's kind of ingrained as who I am as a person, and having it reinforced after 7 years on Mystery Science Theater and then 6 years of Cinematic Titanic.
Right. Is there a B-movie genre that you're still partial to? And I don't say guilty pleasure, because Nigella Lawson said don't feel guilty if you have pleasure from it.
I don't know how necessarily they are classified, but I really love the crazy anthropomorphizing stuff, like The Killer Tree. I think there's the movie we did for Cinematic Titanic that was Killer Trees and Killer Vines, but there's actually a movie called, I think it's called The Killer Tree. So I kind of love that kind of nonsense, and the giant grasshoppers and how seriously they are treated. But yeah, I kind of dig that stuff.
To Hell It Came kind of thing.
Yes, that is it. That's what it is. That's The Killer Tree movie.
Oh, okay. Because there was, I remember as a kid, I don't know if you read these, but there was Danny Peary's cult movie book, as well as the first print of the Golden Turkey Awards, and it was just kind of a hunt to find the films that were written about.
Oh, cool.
All right. Mary, I really, really appreciate your time here. It was good to revisit a bunch of good old stuff. You know, you're a part of a lot of households, including mine, the terrible father with the very patient daughter and wife.
Well, I'm honored.
Yes. So I would say good luck with the book, with your mom's reading list, and what will come of that. And, you know, the invite's always open here at the show.
Well, I appreciate it. Thanks so much, Matthew.
That's Mary Jo Peel of Mystery Science Theater and Cinematic Titanic fame. So thanks to Mary Jo and Ed Trout and McKenna for contributing to today's show. Ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What kind of parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!